Chapter 13. I do not remember going to bed nor getting up, only being by the fire in the gray before daylight with a 10-cup of hot tea in my hand and my breakfast, on the stick, not looking nearly so admirable and very overblown with ashes. The Roman was standing making an oration with gestures in the direction where the light was beginning to show, and I remember wondering if the bastard had talked all night. The head skins were all spread, neatly salted, and the skulls with the horns were leaning against the log and stick house. Imkola was folding the headskins. Kamau brought me the tins, and I told him to open one of fruit. It was cold from the night, and the mixed fruit and the cold, syrupy juice sucked down smoothly. I drank another cup of tea, went in the tent, dressed, put on my dry boots, and we were ready to start. The Roman had said we would be back before lunch. We had the Roman's brother as guide. The Roman was going, as near as I could make out, to spy on one of the other herds of sable, and we were going to locate the other. We started out with the brother head, wearing a toga and carrying a spear, then me with the Springfield slung and my small Zeiss glasses in my pocket, then Imkola with Pop's glasses slung on one side, water canteen on the other, skinning knife, whetstone, extra box of cartridges, and cakes of chocolate in his pockets, and the big gun over his shoulder. Then the old man with the Graflex, Garrick with the movie camera, and the Wanderobo Maasai with a spear and bow and arrows. We said goodbye to the Roman and started out of the thornbush fence just as the sun came through the gap in the hills and shone on the cornfield, the huts, and the blue hills beyond. It promised to be a fine, clear day. The brother led the way through some heavy brush that soaked us all, then through the open forest, then steeply uphill until we were well up on the slope that rose behind the edge of the field where we were camped. Then we were on a good, smooth trail that graded back into these hills above which the sun had not yet risen. I was enjoying the early morning, still a little sleepy, going along a little mechanically, and starting to think that we were a very big outfit to hunt quietly, although everyone seemed to move quietly enough, when we saw two people coming towards us. They were a tall, good-looking man with features like a Roman's, but slightly less noble, wearing a toga and carrying a bow and quiver of arrows, and behind him his wife, very pretty, very modest, very wifely, wearing a garment of brown tan skins and a neck ornament of concentric copper wire circles and many wire circles on her arms and ankles. We halted, said Jumbo, and the brother talked to the seeming tribesman, who had the air of a businessman on the way downtown to his office, and, as they spoke in rapid question and answer, I watched the most freshly brideful wife, who stood a little in profile, so that I saw her pretty pear-shaped breasts and the long, clean, niggery legs, and was studying her pleasant profile most profitably until her husband spoke to her suddenly and sharply, then in explanation and quiet command, and she moved around us, her eyes down, and went on along the trail that we had come alone, we all watching her. The husband was going on with us, it seemed. He had seen the sable that morning, and, slightly suspicious, obviously displeased at leaving that now out-of-sight wife of wives that we all had taken with our eyes, he led us off and to the right along another trail, well-worn and smooth, through woods that look like fall at home, and where you might expect to flush a grouse and have him whir off to the other hill or pitch down in the valley. So, sure enough, we put up our partridges, and watching them fly, I was thinking all the country in the world is the same country and all the hunters are the same people. Then we saw a fresh kudu track beside the trail, and then as we moved through the early morning woods, no undergrowth now, the first sun coming through the tops of the trees, we came on the ever miracle of elephant tracks, each one as big around as the circle you make with your arms, putting your hands together, and sunk a foot deep in the loam of the forest floor, where some bull had passed, traveling after rain. Looking at the way the tracks graded down through the pleasant forest, I thought that we had the mammoths too, a long time ago, and when they traveled through the hills in southern Illinois, they made these same tracks. It was just that we were an older country in America, and the biggest game was gone. We kept along the face of this hill on a pleasant sort of jutting plateau, and then came out to the edge of the hill, where there was a valley and a long open meadow with timber on the far side, and a circle of hills at its upper end, where another valley went off to the left. We stood in the edge of the timber on the face of this hill, looking across the meadow valley, which extended to the open, out in a steep sort of grassy basin, at the upper end where it was backed by the hills. To our left, there were steep, rounded wooded hills, with outcroppings of limestone rock that ran, from where we stood, up to the very head of the valley, and there formed part of the other range of hills that headed it. Below us, to the right, the country was rough and broken in hills and stretches of meadow, and then a steep fall of timber that ran to the blue hills we had seen to the westward beyond the huts where the Roman and his family lived. I judged camp to be straight down below us, and about 5 miles to the northwest through the timber. The husband was standing, talking to the brother, and gesturing and pointing out that he had seen the sable feeding on the opposite side of the meadow valley, and that they must have fed either up or down the valley. We sat in the shelter of the trees, and sent the Wanderobo Maasai down into the valley to look for tracks. He came back and reported that there were no tracks leading down the valley below us and to the westward, so we knew they had fed on up the meadow valley. Now the problem was to so use the terrain that we might locate them and get up and into range of them without being seen. The sun was coming over the hills at the head of the valley and shone on us while everything at the head of the valley was in heavy shadow. I told the outfit to stay where they were in the woods, except for Imkol and the husband who would go with me. We, keeping in the timber and grading up our side of the valley until we could be above and see into the pocket of the curve at the upper end to glass it for the sable. You ask us how this was discussed, worked out, and understood with the bar of language, and I say it was as freely discussed and clearly understood as though we were a cavalry patrol all speaking the same language. We were all hunters, except possibly Garrick, and the whole thing could be worked out, understood, and agreed to without using anything but a forefinger to signal and a hand to caution. We left them and worked very carefully ahead, well back in the timber to get height. Then, when we were far enough up and along, we crawled out onto a rocky place, and being behind a rock, shielded the glasses with my hat so that they would not reflect the sun. Imkola, nodding and grunting, as he saw the practicability of that, we glassed the opposite side of the meadow around the edge of the timber and up into the pocket at the head of the valley. And there they were. Imkola saw them just before I did and pulled my sleeve. "Indio," I said, then held my breath to watch them. All looked very black, big-necked, and heavy. All had the back curving horns. They were a long way away. Some were lying down. One was standing. We could see 7. "Where's the bull?" I whispered. Imkola motioned with his left hand and counted 4 fingers. It was one of those lying down in the tall grass, and the animal did look much bigger and the horns much more sweeping. But we were looking into the morning sun and it was hard to see well. Behind them, a sort of gully ran up into the hill that blocked the end of the valley. Now we knew what we had to do. We must go back, cross the meadow far enough down so we were out of sight, get into the timber on the far side, and work along through the timber to get above the sable. First, we must try to make sure that there were no more of them in the timber or the meadow that we must work through before we made our stalk. I wet my finger and put it up. From the cool side, it seemed as though the breeze came down the valley. Imkola took some dead leaves and crumpled them and tossed them up. They fell a little towards us. The wind was all right, and now we must glass the edge of the timber and check on it.
"Hapana,"
Imkola said finally. I had seen nothing either, and my eyes ached from the pull of the 8-power glasses. We could take a chance on the timber. We might jump something and spook the sable, but we had to take that chance to get around and above them. We made our way back and down and told the others. From where they were, we could cross the valley out of sight of its upper end, and bending low, me with my hat off, we headed down into the high meadow grass and across the deeply cut watercourse that ran down through the center of the meadow, across its rocky shelf, and up the grassy bank on the other side, keeping under the edge of a fold of the valley into the shelter of the woods. Then we headed up through the woods, crouched, in single file, to try to get above the sable. We went forward, making as good time as we could, and still moved quietly. I had made too many stalks on bighorn sheep, only to find them fed away and out of sight when you came around the shoulder of the mountain, to trust these sable to stay where they were. And, since once we were in the timber we could no longer see them, I thought it was important that we come up above them as fast as we could without getting me too blown and shaky for the shooting. Imkola's water bottle made a noise against the cartridges in his pocket, and I stopped and had him pass it to the Wanderobo Maasai. It seemed too many people to be hunting with, but they all moved quietly as snakes, and I was overconfident anyway. I was sure the sable could not see us in the forest, nor wind us. Finally, I was certain we were above them, and that they must be ahead of us, and past where the sun was shining in the thinning of the forest, and below us, under the edge of the hill. I checked on the aperture and the sight being clean, cleaned my glasses, and wiped the sweat from my forehead, remembering to put the used handkerchief in my left pocket so I would not fog my glasses wiping them with it again. Imkola and I and the husband started to work our way to the edge of the timber, finally crawling almost to the edge of the ridge. There were still some trees between us and the open meadow below, and we were behind a small bush and a fallen tree when, raising our heads, we could see them in the grassy open, about 300 yards away, showing big and very dark in the shadow. Between us was scattered open timber full of sunlight and the openness of the gulch. As we watched, two got to their feet and seemed to be standing looking at us. The shot was possible, but it was too bloody long to be certain, and as I lay watching, I felt somebody touch my arm and Garrick, who had crawled up, whispering throatily.
"Piga, piga, buona, do me,"
saying to shoot that it was a bull. I glanced back, and there were the whole outfit on their bellies or hands and knees, the Wanderobo Maasai shaking like a bird dog. I was furious and motioned them all down. So that was a bull, eh? Well, there was a much bigger bull that Imkola and I had seen laying down. The two sable were watching us, and I dropped my head. I thought they might be getting a flash from my glasses. When I looked up again, very slowly, I shaded my eyes with my hand. The two sable had stopped looking and were feeding, but one looked up again nervously, and I saw the dark, heavy-built antelope with scimitar-like horns swung back staring at us. I'd never seen a sable. I knew nothing about them, neither whether their eyesight was keen like a ram who sees you at whatever distance you see him, or like a bull elk who cannot see you at 200 yards unless you move. I was not sure of their size either, but I judged the range to be all of 300 yards. I knew I could hit one if I shot from a sitting position or prone, but I could not say where I would hit him. Then Garrick again,
"Piga, buona, piga."
I turned on him as though to slug him in the mouth. It would have been a great comfort to do it. I truly was not nervous when I first saw the sable, but Garrick was making me nervous.
"Far,"
I whispered to Imkola, who had crawled up and was lying by me.
"Yes."
"Shoot."
"No glasses."
We both watched, using the glasses guardedly. I could see only four. There had been seven. If that was a bull that Garrick pointed out, then they were all bulls. They all looked the same color in the shadow. Their horns all looked big to me. I knew that with mountain sheep, the rams all kept together in bunches until late in the winter when they went with the ewes. That in the late summer you found bull elk in the bunches too, before the rutting season, and that later they herded up together again. We had seen as many as 20 impala rams together up on the Serenia. All right, then they could all be bulls, but I wanted a good one, the best one, and I tried to remember having read something about them, but all I could remember was a silly story of some man seeing the same bull every morning in the same place and never getting up on him. All I could remember was the wonderful pair of horns we had seen in the game warden's office in Arusha. And here were sable now, and I must play it right and get the best one. It never occurred to me that Garrick had never seen a sable, and that he knew no more about them than Imkola or I. "Too far," I said to Imkola.
"Yes."
"Come on," I said, and then waved the others down, and we started crawling up to reach the edge of the hill. Finally, we lay behind a tree and I looked around it. Now we could see their horns clearly with the glasses and could see the other three. One lying down was certainly much the biggest, and the horns, as I caught them in silhouette, seemed to curve much higher and farther back. I was studying them, too excited to be happy as I watched them, when I heard Imkola whisper,
"Wanna?"
I lowered the glasses and looked, and there was Garrick taking no advantage of the cover, crawling on his hands and knees out to join us. I put my hand out, palm toward him, and waved him down, but he paid no attention and came crawling on, as conspicuous as a man walking down a city street on hands and knees. I saw one sable looking towards us, toward him rather, then three more got to their feet. Then the big one got up and stood broadside with head turned towards us as Garrick came up whispering,
"Piga, buona, piga, do me, kabwasana."
There was no choice now. They were definitely spooked, and I lay out flat on my belly, put my arm through the sling, got my elbow settled and my right toe pushing the ground, and squeezed off on the center of the bull's shoulder. But at the roar, I knew it was bad. I was over him. They all jumped and stood looking, not knowing where the noise came from. I shot again at the bull and threw dirt all over him, and they were off. I was on my feet and hit him as he ran, and he was down. Then he was up, and I hit him again, and he took it and was in the bunch. They passed him, and I shot and was behind him. Then I hit him again, and he was trailing slowly, and I knew I had him. Imcola was handing me cartridges, and I was shoving shells down into the damn to hell lousy staggered Springfield magazine, watching the Sable making heavy weather of it crossing the watercourse. We had him all right. I could see he was very sick. The others were trailing up into the timber. In the sunlight on the other side, they looked much lighter, and the one I shot looked lighter, too. They looked a dark chestnut, and on the one I'd shot was almost black. But he was not black, and I felt there was something wrong. I shoved the last shell in, and Garrick was trying to grab my hand to congratulate me, when, below us across the open space with a gully that we could not see, opened onto the head of the valley, Sable started to pass at a running stampede. Good God, I thought. They all looked like the one I had shot, and I was trying to pick a big one. They all looked about the same, and they were crowding, running, and then came the bull. Even in the shadow, he was dead black and shiny as he hit the sun, and his horns swept up high, then back, huge and dark, in two great curves, nearly touching the middle of his back. He was a bull, all right. God, what a bull. "Do me," said Imcola in my ear. "Do me." I hit him, and at the roar, he was down. I saw him up, the others passing, spreading out, and then bunching. I missed him. Then I saw him going almost straight away up the valley in the tall grass, and hit him again, and he went out of sight. The Sable now were going up the hill at the head of the valley, up the hill at our right, up the hill in the timber across the valley, spread out and traveling fast. Now that I had seen a bull, I knew they were all cows, including the first one I had shot. The bull never showed, and I was absolutely sure that we would find him where I had seen him go down in the long grass. The outfit were all up, and I shook off handshaking and thumb-pulling before we started down through the trees and over the edge of the gully into the meadow on a dead run. My eyes, my mind, and all inside of me were full of the blackness of that Sable bull and the sweep of those horns, and I was thanking God I had the rifle reloaded before he came out. But it was excited shooting, all of it, and I was not proud of it. I'd gotten excited and shot at a whole animal instead of the right place, and I was ashamed. But the outfit now were drunk excited. I would have walked, but you could not hold them. They were like a pack of dogs as we ran. As we crossed the meadow opening where we had first seen the seven and went beyond where the bull had gone out of sight, the grass suddenly was high and over our heads, and everyone slowed down. There were two washed-out concealed ravines 10 or 12 feet deep that ran down to the watercourse, and what had looked a smooth grass-filled basin was a very broken, tricky country with grass that was from waist-high to well above our heads. We found blood at once, and it led off to the left across the watercourse and up the hillside on the left toward the head of the valley. I thought that was the first Sable, but it seemed a wider swing than he had seemed to make when we watched him going from above in the timber. I made a circle to look for the big bull, but I could not pick his track from the mass of tracks, and in the high grass and the broken terrain it was difficult to figure just where he had gone. They were all for the blood spoor, and it was like trying to make badly trained bird dogs hunt a dead bird when they are crazy to be off after the rest of the covey.
Do me, I said. Kabwasana. The bull, the big bull.
Yes, everybody agreed.
Here, here.
The blood spoor that crossed the watercourse. Finally, I took that trail thinking we must get them one at a time, and knowing this one was hard hit and the other would keep. Then, too, I might be wrong, and this might be the big bull. He might possibly have turned in the high grass and crossed here as we were running down. I had been wrong before, I remembered. We trailed fast up the hillside into the timber. The blood was splashed freely, made a turn toward the right, climbing steeply, and at the head of the valley in some large rocks jumped a Sable. It went scrambling and bounding off through the rocks. I saw in an instant that it was not hit and knew that, in spite of the back swung dark horns, it was a cow from the dark chestnut color. But I saw this just in time to keep from shooting. I had started to pull when I lowered the rifle.
Manamuki, I said. It's a cow.
Imcola and the two Roman guides agreed. I had very nearly shot. We went on perhaps 5 yards and another Sable jumped, but this one was swaying its head wildly and could not clear the rocks. It was hard hit, and I took my time, shot carefully, and broke its neck. We came up to it lying in the rocks, a large, deep, chestnut-brown animal, almost black, the horns black and curving handsomely back. There was a white patch on the muzzle and back from the eye. There was a white belly, but it was no bull. Imkola, still in doubt, verified this, and feeling of the short, rudimentary teats, said, "Manamuki," and shook his head sadly. It was the first big bull that Garrick had pointed out. "Bull down there," I pointed.
"Yes,"
said Imkola. I thought that we would give him time to get sick if he were only wounded, and then go down and find him. So I had Imkola make the cuts for taking off the head skin, and we would leave the old man to skin out the head while we went down after the bull. I drank some water from the canteen. I was thirsty after the run and the climb, and the sun was up now and it was getting hot. Then we went down the opposite side of the valley from that we had just come up, trailing the wounded cow, and below in the tall grass, casting in circles, commenced to hunt for the trail of the bull. We could not find it. The sable had been running in a bunch as they came out, and any individual track was confused or obliterated. We found some blood on the grass stems where I had first hit him, then lost it, then found it again where the other blood spore turned off. Then the tracks had all split up as they had gone, fanwise, up the valley and the hills, and we could not find it again. Finally, I found blood on a grass blade about 50 yards up the valley, and I plucked it and held it up. This was a mistake. I should have brought them to it. Already everyone but Imkola was losing faith in the bull. He was not there. He had disappeared. He had vanished. Perhaps he had never existed. Who could say he was a real bull? If I had not plucked the grass with the blood on it, I might have held them. Growing there with blood on it, it was evidence. Plucked it meant nothing except to me and Imkola. But I could find no more blood, and they were all hunting half-heartedly now. The only possible way was to quarter every foot of the high grass and trace every foot of the gullies. It was very hot now, and they were only making a pretense of hunting. Garrick came up.
"All cows," he said. "No bull, just biggest cow. You killed biggest cow. We found her. Smaller cow, get away."
"You wind-blown son of a bitch," I said, then using my fingers. "Listen, 7 cows, then 15 cows, and 1 bull. Bull hit. Here."
"All cows," said Garrick.
"One big cow hit. 1 bull hit. I was so sure-sounding that they agreed to this and searched for a while, but I could see they were losing belief in the bull. If I had one good dog, I thought, just one good dog. Then Garrick came up.
"All cows," he said, "very big cows."
"You're a cow," I said, "very big cow." This got a laugh from the Wanderobo Maasai, who was getting to look a picture of sick misery. The brother half believed in the bull, I could see. Husband, by now, did not believe any of us. I don't think he even believed in the kudu of the night before. Well, after the shooting, I did not blame him. Imkola came up.
"Hapana,"
he said glumly. Then, "Bwana, you shot that bull?"
"Yes,"
I said. For a minute, I began to doubt whether there ever was a bull. Then I saw again his heavy, high-withered blackness and the high rise of his horns before they swept back, him running with the bunch, shoulder higher than them, and black as hell. And as I saw it, Imkola saw it again too through the rising mist of a savage's unbelief in what he can no longer see.
"Yes," Imkola agreed. "I see him. You shoot him."
I told it again.
7 cows. Shoot biggest. 15 cows. 1 bull. Hit that bull."
They all believed it now for a moment and circled, searching, but the faith died at once in the heat of the sun and the tall grass blowing.
"All cows,"
Garrick said. The Wanderobo Maasai nodded, his mouth open. I could feel the comfortable lack of faith coming over me, too. It was a damn sight easier not to hunt in that sun, in that shadeless pocket, and in the sun on that steep hillside. I told Imkola we would hunt up the valley on both sides, finish skinning out the head, and he and I would come down alone and find the bull. You could not hunt them against that unbelief. I had no chance to train them, no power to discipline. If there had been no law, I would have shot Garrick, and they would all have hunted or cleared out. I think they would have hunted. Garrick was not popular. He was simply poison. Imkola and I came back down the valley, quartered it like dogbirds, circled, and followed and checked track after track. I was hot and very thirsty. The sun was something serious by now.
"Hapana,"
Imkola said. We could not find him. Whatever he was, we had lost him. Maybe he was a cow. Maybe it was all goofy, I thought, letting the unbelief come in as a comfort. We were going to hunt up the side hill to the right, and then we would have checked it all, and would take the cow head into camp and see what the Roman had located. I was dead thirsty and drained the canteen. We would get water in camp. We started up the hill, and I jumped a sable in some brush. I almost loosed off at it before I saw it was a cow. That showed how one could be hidden, I thought. We would have to get the men and go over it all again. And then, from the old man, came a wild shouting. Do me, in a high, screaming shout. Where? I shouted, running across the hill toward him. There, he shouted, pointing into the timber on the other side of the head of the valley. There he goes, there. We came on a dead run, but the bull was out of sight in the timber on the hillside. The old man said he was huge. He was black, he had great horns, and he came by him 10 yards away, hit in two places, in the gut and high up in the rump, hard hit but going fast, crossing the valley, through the boulders, and going up the hillside. I gut shot him, I thought. Then, as he was going away, I laid that one on his stern. He lay down and was sick, and we missed him. Then, when we were past, he jumped. Come on, I said. Everyone was excited and ready to go now, and the old man was chattering about the bull as he folded the head skin and put the head up on his own head, and we started across through the rocks and up, quartering up onto the hillside. There, where the old man had pointed, was a very big sable track, the hoof marks spread wide, the tracks grating up into the timber, and there was blood, plenty of it. We trailed him fast, hoping to jump him and have a shot, and it was easy trailing in the shade of the trees with plenty of blood to follow. But he kept climbing, grading up around the hill, and he was traveling fast. We kept the blood bright and wet, but we could not come up on him. I did not track, but kept watching ahead, thinking I might see him as he looked back, or see him down, or cutting down across the hill through the timber. Imkola and Garrick were tracking, aided by everyone but the old man who was staggering along with the sable skull and head skin held on his own gray head. Imkola had hung the empty water bottle on him, and Garrick had loaded him with the cinema camera. It was hard going for the old man. Once we came up on a place where the bull had rested and watched his backtrack. There was a little pool of blood on a rock where he had stood, behind some bushes, and I cursed the wind that blew our scent on ahead of us. There was a big breeze blowing now, and I was certain we had no chance of surprising him. Our scent would keep everything moving out of the way ahead of us as long as anything could move. I thought of trying to circle ahead with Imkola and let them track, but we were moving fast, the blood was still bright on the stones and on the fallen leaves and grass, and the hills were too steep for us to make a circle. I did not see how we could lose him. Then he took us up and into a rocky ravine-cut country where the trailing was slow and the climbing difficult. Here, I thought, we would jump him in a gully. But the spatters of blood, not so bright now, went on around the boulders, over the rocks, and up, and left us on a rim rock ledge. He must have gone down from there. It was too steep above for him to have gone over the top of the hill. There was no other way to go but down. But how had he gone, and down which ravine? I sent them looking down three possible ways, and got out on the rim to try and sight him. They could not find any spoor, and then the Wanderobo Maasai called from below, and to the right, that he had blood, and climbing down we saw it on a rock and then followed it in occasionally drying splatters down through a steep descent to the meadow below. I was encouraged when he started downhill, and in the knee-high heavy grass of the meadow trailing was easy again, because the grass was brushed against his belly, and while you could not see tracks clearly without stooping double and parting the grass to look, yet the blood spoor was plain on the grass blades. But it was dry now, and dully shiny, and I knew we had lost much time on him when he rim-rocked us on the hill. Finally, his trail crossed the dry watercourse about where we had first come in sight of the meadow in the morning and led away into the sloping, sparsely wooded country on the far side. There were no clouds, and I could feel the sun now, not just as heat, but as a heavy, deadly weight on my head, and I was very thirsty. It was very hot, but it was not the heat that bothered. It was the weight of the sun. Garrick had given up tracking seriously and was only contributing theatrical successes of discovering blood when Imkola and I were checked. He would do no routine tracking anymore, but would rest and then track in irritating spurts. The Wandorobo Maasai was useless as a blue jay, and I had Imkola give him the big rifle to carry so that we would get some use out of him. The Roman's brother was obviously not a hunter, and the husband was not very interested. He did not seem to be a hunter either. As we trailed slowly, the ground, hard now as the sun had baked it, the blood only black spots and splatters on the short grass. One by one, the brother, Garrick, and the Wandorobo Maasai dropped out and sat in the shade of the scattered trees. The sun was terrific, and as it was necessary to track with heads bent down and stooping, in spite of a handkerchief spread over my neck, I had a pounding ache in my head. Imkola was tracking slowly, steadily, and absolutely absorbed in the problem. His bare, bald head gleamed with sweat, and when it ran down in his eyes, he would pluck a grass stem, hold it with each hand, and shave the sweat off his forehead and bald black crown with the stem. We went on slowly. I had always sworn to Pop that I could out-track Imkola, but I realized now that in the past, I had been giving a sort of Garrick performance in picking up the spoor when it was lost, and that in straight, steady trailing, now in the heat, with the sun really bad, truly bad so you could feel what it was doing to your head, cooking it to hell, trailing in short grass on hard ground where the blood spot was a dry black blister on a grass blade, difficult to see, that you must find the next black spot perhaps 20 yards away, one holding the last blood while the other found the next, then going on, one on each side of the trail, pointing with a grass stem at the spots to save talking, until it ran out again, and you marked the last blood with your eye, and both made casts to pick it up again, signaling with a hand up, my mouth too dry to talk, a heat shimmer over the ground now, and when you straightened up to let your neck stop aching and looked ahead, I knew Imkola was immeasurably the better man, and the better tracker. Have to tell Pop, I thought. At this point, Imkola made a joke. My mouth was so dry that it was hard to talk. Buona, Imkola said, looking at me when I had straightened up and was leaning my neck back to get the crick out of it. Yes? Whiskey? And he offered me the flask. You bastard, I said in English, and he chuckled and shook his head. Hapana whiskey? You savage, I said in Swahili. We started tracking again, Imkola shaking his head and very amused. And in a little while, the grass was longer and it was easier again. We crossed all that semi-open country we had seen from the hillside in the morning, and going down a slope that tracks swung back into the high grass. In this higher grass, I found that by half shutting my eyes, I could see his trail where he had shouldered through the grass, and I went ahead fast, without trailing by the blood, to Imkola's amazement. But then we came out on a very short grass and rock again, and now the trailing was the hardest yet. He was not bleeding much now. The sun and the heat must have dried the wounds, and we found only an occasional small, starry splatter on the rocky ground. Garrick came up and made a couple of brilliant discoveries of blood spots, then sat down under a tree. Under another tree I could see the poor old Wandorobo Maasai holding his first and last job as a gun bearer. Under another was the old man, the sable head beside him like some black mass symbol, his equipment hanging from his shoulders. Imkola and I went on trailing very slowly and laboriously across the long stony slope and back and up into another tree-scattered meadow and through it and into a long field with piled-up boulders at the end. In the middle of this field we lost the trail completely and circled and hunted for nearly 2 hours before we found blood again. The old man found it for us below the boulders and to the right and half a mile away. He had gone ahead down there on his own idea of what the bull would have done. The old man was a hunter. Then we trailed him very slowly onto hard stony ground a mile away, but we could not trail him from there. The ground was too hard to leave a track, and we never found blood again. Then we hunted on our various theories of where the bull would go, but the country was too big, and we had no luck.
No good, Imkola said.
I straightened up and went over to the shade of a big tree. It felt cool as water, and the breeze cooled my skin through the wet shirt. I was thinking about the bull and wishing to God I had never hit him. Now I had wounded him and lost him. I believe he kept right on traveling and went out of that country. He never showed any tendency to circle back. Tonight he would die and the hyenas would eat him, or, worse, they would get him before he died, hamstringing him and pulling his guts out while he was alive. The first one that hit that blood spore would stay with it until he found him. Then he would call up the others. I felt a son of a bitch to have hit him and not killed him. I did not mind killing anything, any animal, if I killed it cleanly. They all had to die, and my interference with the nightly and the seasonal killing that went on all the time was very minute, and I had no guilty feeling at all. We ate the meat and kept the hides and horns, but I felt rotten sick over the sable bull. Besides, I wanted him. I wanted him damn badly. I wanted him more than I would admit. Well, we had played our string out with him. Our chance was at the start when he was down and we missed him. We had lost that. No. Our best chance, the only chance a rifleman should ever ask, was when I had shot, and shot at the whole animal instead of calling the shot. It was my own lousy fault. I was a son of a bitch to have gut-shot him. It came from overconfidence in being able to do a thing, and then omitting one of the steps in how it is done. Well, we had lost him. I doubt if there was a dog in the world could trail him now in that heat. Still, that was the only chance. I got out the dictionary and asked the old man if there were any dogs at the Roman's place. No, said the old man. Habana. We made a very wide circle, and I sent the brother and the husband out in another circle. We found nothing, no trace, no tracks, no blood, and I told Imcola we would start for camp. The Roman's brother and the husband went up the valley to get the meat of the sable cow we had shot. We were beaten. Imcola and I ahead, the others following. We went across the long heat haze of the open country, down to cross the dry water course, and up and into the grateful shade of the tree through the woods. As we were going along through the broken sunlight and shadow, the floor of the forest smooth and springy where we cut across to save distance from the trail, we saw, less than 100 yards away, a herd of sable standing in the timber looking at us. I pulled back the bolt and looked for the best pair of horns.
Dumi, Garrick whispered. Dumi Kabasana.
I looked where he pointed. It was a very big cow sable, dark chestnut, white marks on the face, white belly, heavy built, and with a fine curving pair of horns. She was standing broadside to us with her head turned, looking. I looked carefully at the whole lot. They were all cows, evidently the bunch whose bull I had wounded and lost, and they'd come over the hill and herded up again together here. We go to camp, I said to Imcola. As we started forward, the sable jumped and ran past us, crossing the trail ahead. At every good pair of cow horns, Garrick said, Bull, buona, big, big bull, shoot, buona, shoot, oh, shoot. All cows, I said to Imcola when they were past, running in a panic through the sun-splashed timber.
Yes,
he agreed. Old man, I said, the old man came up. Let the guide carry that, I said. The old man lowered the cow sable head.
No,
said Garrick. Yes, I said. Bloody well, yes. We went on through the woods towards camp. I was feeling better, much better. All through the day, I had never thought once of the kudu. Now we were coming home to where they were waiting. It seemed much longer coming home, although usually the return over a new trail is shorter. I was tired all the way into my bones. My head felt cooked, and I was thirstier than I'd ever been in my life. But suddenly, walking through the woods, it was much cooler. A cloud had come over the sun. We came out of the timber and down onto the flat in the side of the thorn fence. The sun was behind a bank of clouds now, and then in a little while the sky was covered completely and the clouds looked heavy and threatening. I thought perhaps this had been the last clear hot day, unusual heat before the rains. First, I thought, if it had only rained so the ground would hold a track, we would have stayed with that bull forever. Then, looking at the heavy, woolly clouds that so quickly had covered all the sky, I thought that if we were going to join the outfit and get the car across the 10-mile stretch of black cotton road on the way to Handeni, we had better start. I pointed to the sky.
Bad,
Imcola agreed.
Go to the camp of Buana, Imkabwa?
Better,
then vigorously accepting the decision.
Indio, Indio.
We go, I said. Arrived at the thorn fence and the hut, we broke camp fast. There was a runner there from our last camp who had brought a note written before POM and Pop had left and bringing my mosquito net. There was nothing in the note, only good luck, and that they were starting. I drank some water from one of our canvas bags, sat on a petrol tin, and looked at the sky. I could not conscientiously chance staying. If it rained here, we might not even be able to get out to the road. If it rained heavily on the road, we would never get out to the coast that season. Both the Austrian and Pop had said that. I had to go. That was settled, so there was no use to think how much I wanted to stay. The day's fatigue helped make the decision easy. Everything was being loaded into the car, and they were all gathering up their meat from the sticks around the ashes of the fire.
"Don't you want to eat, Buona?" Kamau asked me.
"No," I said, then in English, too bloody tired.
"Eat. You are hungry."
Later, in the car. Imkola went by with a load, his big, flat face completely blank again. It only came alive about hunting or some joke. I found a tin cup by the fire and called to him to bring the whiskey, and the blank face cracked at the eyes and mouth into a smile as he took the flask out of his pocket.
"With water better?"
he said. "You black Chinaman." They were all working fast, and the Roman's woman came over and stood a little way away watching the carrying and the packing of the car. There were two of them, good-looking, well-built, and shy, but interested. The Roman was not back yet. I felt very badly to go off like this with no explanation to him. I liked the Roman very much and had a high regard for him. I took a drink of the whiskey and water and looked at the two pairs of kudu horns that leaned against the wall of the chicken coop hut. From the white, cleanly picked skulls, the horns rose in slow spirals that spreading made a turn, another turn, and then curved delicately into those smooth, ivory-like points. One pair was narrower and taller against the side of the hut. The other was almost as tall, but wider in spread and heavier in beam. They were the color of black walnut meats, and they were beautiful to see. I went over and stood the Springfield against the hut between them, and the tips reached past the muzzle of the rifle. As Kamau came back from carrying a load to the car, I told him to bring the camera and then had him stand beside them while I took a picture. Then he picked them up, each had a load, and carried them over to the car. Garrick was talking loudly and in a roostery way to the Roman's woman. As near as I could make out, he was offering them the empty petrol boxes in exchange for a piece of something. "Come here," I called to him. He came over, still feeling smart. "Listen," I told him in English. "If I get through this safari without socking you, it's going to be a bloody marvel. And if I ever hit you, I'll break your mucking jaw. That's all." He did not understand the words, but the tone made it clearer than if I had gotten something out of the dictionary to tell him. I stood up and motioned to the woman that they could have the petrol tins and the cases. I was damned if I could not have anything to do with them if I would let Garrick make any passes. "Get in the car," I told him. "No," as he started to make delivery of one of the petrol tins. "In the car." He went over to the car. We were all packed now and ready to go. The horns were curling out of the back of the car, tied onto the loads. I left some money for the Roman and one of the kudu hides with the boy. Then we got in the car. I got in the front seat with the Wanderobo Maasai. In back were Imkola, Garrick, and the runner, who is a man from the old man's village by the road. The old man was crouched on top of the loads in back, close under the roof. We waved and started, passing more of the Roman's household, the older and uglier part, roasting up piles of meat by a log fire beside the trail that came up from the river through the maize field. We made the crossing all right. The creek was down, and the banks had dried, and I looked back at the field, the Romans' huts, and the stockade where we had camped, and the blue hills dark under the heavy sky, and I felt very badly not to have seen the Roman and explained why we had gone off like this. Then we were going through the woods, following our trail and trying to make time to get out before dark. We had trouble twice, at boggy places, and Garrick seemed to be in a state of great hysteria, ordering people about when we were cutting brush and shoveling until I was certain I would have to hit him. He called for corporal punishment the way a showing-off child does for a spanking. Kamau and Imkola were both laughing at him. He was playing the victorious leader home from the chase now. I thought it was really a shame that he could not have his ostrich plumes. Once, when we were stuck and I was shoveling, and he was stooping over in a frenzy of advice and command-giving, I brought the handle of the shovel with manifest unintention up hard into his belly, and he sat down backwards. I never looked toward him, and Imkola, Kamau, and I could not look at each other for fear we would laugh. "I am hurt," he said, in astonishment, getting to his feet. "Never get near a man shoveling," I said in English. "Damn dangerous." "I am hurt," said Garrick, holding his belly. "Rub it," I told him, and rubbed mine to show him how. We all got in the car again, and I began to feel sorry for the poor, bloody, useless, theatrical bastard, so I told him Cola I would drink a bottle of beer. He got one out from under the loads in the back. We were going through the Deer Park-looking country now, opened it, and I drank it slowly. I looked around and saw Garrick was all right now, letting his mouth run freely again. He rubbed his belly and seemed to be telling them what a hell of a man he was and how he had never felt it. I could feel the old man watching me from up under the roof as I drank the beer.
"Old man," I said.
"Yes, Buona?"
"A present," and I handed what was left in the bottle back. There wasn't much left but the foam and a very little beer.
"Beer?"
asked him Cola.
"By God, yes," I said.
I was thinking about beer, and in my mind was back to that year in the spring when we walked on the mountain road to the Bandalier and the beer-drinking contest where we failed to win the calf and came home that night around the mountain with the moonlight on the fields of narcissus that grew on the meadows and how we were drunk and talked about how we would describe that light on that paleness. And the brown beer sitting at the wood tables under the wisteria vine at Aigle when we came in across the Rhone Valley from fishing the Stalkalper with the horse chestnut trees in bloom and Chink and I again discussing writing and whether you could call them waxen candelabras. God, what a bloody literary discussion we had. We were literary as hell when just after the war, and later there was the good beer at Lips at midnight after Mascal Ledoux at the Cirque de Paris, or Roti Ledoux, or after any other great fight where you lost your voice and were still too excited to turn in. But beer was mostly those years just after the war with Chink and in the mountains. Flags for the fusilier, crags for the mountaineer, for the English poet's beer, strong beer for me. That was Chink then, quoting Robert Graves then. We outgrew some countries and we went to others, but beer was still a bloody marvel. The old man knew it too. I had seen it in his eye the first time he saw me take a drink.
"Beer?"
said Mkola. He had it open, and I looked out at the park-like country, the engine hot under my boots, the Wanderoba Maasai as strong as ever beside me, Kamau watching the grooves of the tire tracks in the green turf, and I hung my booted legs over the side to let my feet cool and drank the beer and wished old Chink was along. Captain Eric Edward Dorman Smith, M.C., of His Majesty's 5th Fusiliers. Now, if he were there, we would discuss how to describe this Deer Park country and whether Deer Park was enough to call it. Pop and Chink were much alike. Pop was older and more tolerant for his years and the same sort of company. I was learning under Pop, while Chink and I had discovered a big part of the world together, and then our ways had gone a long way apart. But that damn sable bull, I should have killed him. But it was a running shot. To hit him at all, I had to use him all as a target. "Yes, you bastard. But what about the cow you missed twice, prone, standing broadside? Was that a running shot? No. If I'd gone to bed last night, I would not have done that. Or if I'd wiped out the boar to get the oil out, she would not have thrown high the first time. Then I would not have pulled down and shot under her the second shot. Every damn thing is your own fault if you're any good. I thought I could shoot a shotgun better than I could, and I'd lost plenty of money backing my opinion, but I knew, coldly and outside myself, that I could shoot a rifle on game as well as any son of a bitch that ever lived. Like hell I could. So what? So I gut shot a sable bull and let him get away. Could I shoot as well as I thought I could? Sure. Then why did I miss on that cow? Hell, everybody is off sometime. You've got no bloody business to be off. Who the hell are you, my conscience? Listen, I'm all right with my conscience. I know just what kind of a son of a bitch I am, and I know what I can do well. If I hadn't had to leave and pull out, I would have got a sable bull. You know the Roman was a hunter. There was another herd. Why did I have to make a one-night stand? Was that any way to hunt? Hell no. I'd make some money some way, and when we came back, we would come to the old man's village in trucks, then pack in with porters so there wouldn't be any damn car to worry about, send the porters back, and make a camp in the timber up the stream above the Romans and hunt the country slowly, living there and hunting out each day, sometimes laying off and riding for a week, or riding half the day, or every other day, and get to know it as I knew the country around the lake where we were brought up. I'd see the buffalo feeding where they had lived, and when the elephants came through the hills, we would see them and watch them breaking branches, and not have to shoot. And I would lie in fallen leaves and watch the kudu feed out and never fire a shot unless I saw a better head than this one in back. And instead of trailing that sable bull gut shot to hell all day, I'd lie behind a rock and watch them on a hillside and see them long enough so that they belonged to me forever. Sure, if Garrick didn't take his Bwana Simba back in there and shoot the country out. But if he did, I'd go on down beyond those hills, and there would be another country where a man could live and hunt, if he had time to live and hunt. They'd gone in wherever a car could go. But there must be pockets like this all over, that no one knows of, that the cars pass all along the road. They all hunt the same places.
Beer?
Asked Imkola. Yes, I said. Sure, you couldn't make a living. Everyone had explained that. The locusts came and ate your crops, and the monsoon failed, and the rains did not come, and everything dried up and died. There were ticks and fly to kill the stock, and the mosquitoes gave you fever, and maybe you got blackwater. Your cattle would die, and you would get no price for your coffee. It took an Indian to make money from sisal, and on the coast every coconut plantation meant a man ruined by the idea or making money from copra. A white hunter worked 3 months out of the year and drank for 12, and the government was ruining the country for the benefit of the Hindu and the natives. That was what they told you. Sure. But I did not want to make money. All I wanted was to live in it and have time to hunt. Already I had had one of the diseases and had experienced the necessity of washing a 3-inch bit of my large intestine with soap and water and tucking it back where it belonged an unnumbered amount of times a day. There were remedies which cured this, and it was well worth going through for what I had seen and where I had been. Besides, I caught that on the dirty boat out from Marseille. POM hadn't been ill a day, neither had Carl. I loved this country, and I felt at home, and where a man feels at home outside of where he's born is where he's meant to go. Then, in my grandfather's time, Michigan was a malaria-ridden state. They called it fever and ague. And in Tortugas, where I'd spent months, 1,000 men once died of yellow fever. New continents and islands try to frighten you with diseases, as a snake hisses. The snake may be poisonous, too. You kill them off. Hell, what I had a month ago would have killed me in the old days, before they invented the remedies. Maybe it would, and maybe I would have gotten well. It is easier to keep well in a good country by taking simple precautions than to pretend that a country which is finished is still good. A continent ages quickly once we come. The natives live in harmony with it, but the foreigner destroys, cuts down the trees, drains the water, so that the water supply is altered, and in a short time the soil, once the sod is turned under, is cropped out, and next it starts to blow away as it has blown away in every old country, and as I had seen it start to blow away in Canada. The earth gets tired of being exploited. A country wears out quickly unless man puts back in it all his residue and that of all his beasts. When he quits using beasts and uses machines, the earth defeats him quickly. The machine cannot reproduce, nor does it fertilize the soil, and it eats what he cannot raise. A country was made to be as we found it. We are the intruders, and after we are dead, we may have ruined it, but it will still be there, and we don't know what the next changes are. I suppose they all end up like Mongolia. I would come back to Africa, but not to make a living from it. I could do that with 2 pencils and a few 100 sheets of the cheapest paper. But I would come back to where it pleased me to live, to really live, not just let my life pass. Our people went to America because that was the place to go then. It had been a good country, and we had made a bloody mess of it, and I would go now somewhere else, as we had always had the right to go somewhere else, and as we had always gone. You could always come back. Let the others come to America who did not know that they had come too late. Our people had seen it at its best, and fought for it when it was well worth fighting for. Now I would go somewhere else. We always went in the old days, and there were still good places to go. I knew a good country when I saw one. Here there was game, plenty of birds, and I liked the natives. Here I could shoot and fish, that and writing and reading, and seeing pictures was all I cared about doing. And I could remember all the pictures. Other things I liked to watch, but they were what I liked to do. That and skiing. But my legs were bad now, and it was not worth the time you spent hunting good snow anymore. You saw too many people skiing now. Now, the car making a turn around a bank and crossing a green, grassy field, we came in sight of the Maasai village. When the Maasai saw us, they started running out and we stopped, surrounded by them just below the stockade. They were the young warriors who had run with us, and now their women and the children all came out to see us. The children were all quite young, and the men and women all seemed the same age. There were no old people. They all seemed to be our great friends, and we gave a very successful party with refreshments in the shape of our bread, which they all ate with much laughing. The men first, then the women. Then I had M'Kola open the 2 tins of mincemeat and the plum pudding, and I cut these into rations and passed them out. I had heard and read that the Maasai subsisted only on the blood of their cattle mixed with milk, drawing the blood off from a wound in a vein of the neck made by shooting an arrow at close range. These Maasai, however, ate bread, cold mincemeat, and plum pudding with great relish, and much laughter and joking. One very tall and handsome one kept asking me something that I did not understand, and then 5 or 6 more joined in. Whatever this was, they wanted it very badly. Finally, the tallest one made a very strange face and emitted a sound like a dying pig. I understood finally. He was asking if we had one of those, and I pressed the button of the klaxon. The children ran screaming. The warriors laughed and laughed, and then as Kamau, in response to popular demand, pressed the klaxon again and again, I watched the look of utter rapture and ecstasy on the woman's faces and knew that with that klaxon he could have had any woman in the tribe. Finally, we had to go, and after distributing the empty beer bottles, the labels from the bottles, and finally the bottle caps, picked up by M'Kola from the floor, we left klaxoning the women into ecstasy, the children into panic, and the warriors into delight. The warriors ran with us for a good way, but we had to make time. The going was good through the park-like country, and in a little while we waved to the last of them standing straight and tall, in their brown skin garments, their club pigtails hanging, and their faces stained a red-brown, leaning on their spears, looking after us, and smiling. The sun was almost down, and as I did not know the road, I had the runner get in front to sit with the Wandaroba Maasai and help direct Kamau, and I sat in the back with M'Kola and Garrick. We were out of the park country and onto the dry, bush-spattered plain before the sun went down, and I had another bottle of the German beer, and watching the country saw, suddenly, that all the trees were full of white storks. I did not know whether they were there in migration or were following the locusts, but in the twilight they were lovely to see, and deeply moved by them, I gave the old man a good 2 fingers of beer that was left in the bottom of the bottle. On the next bottle I forgot, and drank it all before I remembered the old man. There were still storks in the trees, and we saw some Grant's gazelles feeding off to the right. A jackal, like a gray fox, trotted across the road. So I told M'Kola to open another bottle, and we were through the plain and climbing the long slope toward the road in the village, and the 2 mountains in sight now. And it was almost dark and quite cold when I handed the bottle to the old man, who took it where he was crouched up under the roof and nursed it tenderly. At the village we stopped in the road in the dark, and I paid the runner the amount it said to give him in the note he had brought. I paid the old man the amount Pop said to pay him, and a bonus. Then there was a big dispute among them all. Garrick was to go to the main camp to get his money. Abdullah insisted upon going along. He did not trust Garrick. The Wandaroba Maasai insisted pitifully that he go. He was sure the others would cheat him out of his share, and I was fairly sure they would too. There was petrol that had been left for us to use in case we were short, and for us to bring in any event. We were overloaded, and I did not know how the road was ahead, but I thought we might carry Abdullah and Garrick and squeeze in the Wandaroba Maasai. There was no question of the old man going. He had been paid off and had agreed to the amount, but now he would not leave the car. He crouched on top of the load and hung onto the rope, saying, I am going with Bwana. M'Kola and Kamau had to break his handholds and pull him off to reload, him shouting, I want to go with Bwana. While they were loading in the dark, he held onto my arm and talked very quietly in a language that I could not understand. You have the shillings, I said.
Yes, Bwana,
he said. That was not what it was about. The money was all right. Then, when we started to get into the car, He broke away and started to climb up through the back and onto the loads. Garrick and Abdullah pulled him down. You can't go. There isn't room. He talked to me softly again, begging and pleading. No, there is no room. I remember I had a small penknife, and I got it out of my pocket and put it in his hand. He pushed it back in my hand.
No, he said, no.
He was quiet then and stood by the road. But when we started, he started to run after the car, and I could hear him in the dark screaming,
Buana! I want to go with Buana!
We went up on the road, the headlights making it seem like a boulevard after where we had been. We drove 55 miles on the road in the dark night without incident. I stayed awake until after we were through the bad part, a long plain of deeply rutted black cotton where the headlights picked out the trail through the bushes, and then, when the road was better, I went to sleep, waking occasionally to see the headlights shining on a wall of tall trees or a naked bank, or when we ground in low gear up a steep place, the lights slanting up ahead. Finally, when the speedometer showed 50 miles, we stopped and woke a native in his hut and Imkola asked about the camp. I slept again and then woke as we were turning off the road and on a track through trees with the fires of the camp showing ahead. Then as we came to where our lights shone on the green tents, I shouted and we all commenced to shout and blew the klaxon and I let the gun off, a flame cutting up in the dark and it making a great noise. Then we stopped, and out from Pop's tent, I saw him coming, thick and heavy in his dressing gown, and then he had his arms around my shoulders and said,
You goddamn bullfighter!
And I was clapping him on the back, and I said, Look at them, Pop.
Oh, I saw them, he said. The whole back of the car is full of them.
Then I was holding POM tight, she feeling very small inside the quilted bigness of the dressing gown, and we were saying things to each other. Then Carl came out, and I said, Hi, Carl.
I'm so damn glad, he said. They're marvelous.
Imkola had the horns down by now, and he and Kamau were holding them so they could all see them in the light of the fire. What'd you get? I asked Carl.
Just another one of those, what do you call them, Tandala?
Swell, I said. I knew I had one no one could beat, and I hoped he had a good one, too. How big was he?
57,
Carl said. Let's see him, I said, cold in the pit of my stomach.
He's over there, Pop said,
and we went over. They were the biggest, widest, darkest, longest, curling, heaviest, most unbelievable pair of kudu horns in the world. Suddenly, poisoned with envy, I did not want to see mine again. Never. Never. That's great, I said, with the words coming out as cheerfully as a croak. I tried it again. That's swell. How'd you get him?
There were three, Carl said. They were all as big as that. I couldn't tell which was the biggest. We had a hell of a time, hit him four or five times.
He's a wonder, I said. I was getting so I could do it a little better, but would not fool anybody yet.
I'm awfully glad you got yours, Carl said. They're beauties. I want to hear all about them in the morning. I know you're tired tonight. Good night.
He went off, delicate as always, so we could talk about it if we wanted to. Come on over and have a drink, I called.
No, thanks. I think I better go to bed. I got a sort of headache.
Good night, Carl.
Good night. Good night, poor old mama.
Good night, we all said. By the fire with whiskey and soda, we talked and I told them all about it.
Perhaps they'll find the bull, Pop said. We'll offer a reward for the horns. Have them sent to the game department. How big is your biggest one?
52.
Over the curve?
Yes, maybe he's a little better.
Inches don't mean anything, Pop said. They're damned wonderful kudu.
Sure. But why does he have to beat me so bloody badly?
He's got the luck, Pop said. God, what a kudu. I've only seen one head killed over 50 in my life before. That was up in Kalal.
We knew he had it when we left the other camp. The truck came in and told us, POM said. I've spent all my time praying for you. Ask Mr. J.P.
You'll never know what it meant to see the car come into the firelight with those damned horns sticking out, Pop said. You old bastard.
It's wonderful, POM said. Let's go and look at them again.
You can always remember how you shot them. That's what you really get out of it, Pop said. They're damned wonderful kudu.
But I was bitter, and I was bitter all night long. In the morning, though, it was gone. It was all gone, and I've never had it again. Pop and I were up and looking at the heads before breakfast. It was a gray, overcast morning and cold. The rains were coming.
"They're three marvelous kudu," he said.
"They look all right with the big one this morning," I said. They did, too, strangely enough. I had accepted the big one now and was happy to see him, and that Carl had him. When you put them side by side, they looked all right. They really did. They all were big.
"I'm glad you're feeling better," Pop said. "I'm feeling better myself."
"I'm really glad he has him," I said truly. "Mine'll hold me."
"We have very primitive emotions," he said. "It's impossible not to be competitive. Spoils everything, though."
"I'm all through with that," I said. "I'm all right again. I had quite a trip, you know."
"Did you not?" said Pop.
"Pop, what does it mean when they shake hands and get a hold of your thumb and pull it?"
"It's on the order of blood brotherhood, but a little less formal. Who's been doing that to you?"
"Everybody but Kamau."
"You're getting to be a hell of a fellow," Pop said. "You must be an old-timer out there. Tell me, are you much of a tracker and birdshot?"
"Go to hell."
"Imkola has been doing that with you, too."
"Yes."
"Well, well," said Pop. "Let's get little Memsahib and have some breakfast. Not that I'm feeling up to it."
"I am," I said. "I haven't eaten anything since day before yesterday."
"Drank some beer, though, didn't you?"
"Ah, yes."
"Beer's a food," Pop said.
We got the little Memsahib and old Carl and had a very jolly breakfast. A month later, POM, Carl, and Carl's wife, who'd come out and joined us at Haifa, were sitting in the sun against a stone wall by the Sea of Galilee, eating some lunch and drinking a bottle of wine and watching the grebes out on the lake. The hills made shadows on the water, which was flat calm and rather stagnant-looking. There were many grebes, making spreading wakes in the water as they swam, and I was counting them and wondering why they never were mentioned in the Bible. I decided that those people were not naturalists.
"I'm not going to walk on it,"
Carl said, looking out at the dreary lake.
"It's been done already."
"You know," POM said, "I can't remember it. I can't remember Mr. JP's face. And he's beautiful. I think about him and think about him, and I can't see him. It's terrible. He isn't the way he looks in a photograph. In a little while, I won't be able to remember him at all. Already, I can't see him."
"You must remember him," Carl said to her.
"I can remember him," I said. "I'll write you a piece sometime and put him in."